haste among them. Two more talked together on the other side of the gate. At least four boats patrolled Voss Island, going around it in measured circles. It was a good thing Kylar wasn't planning on getting into the castle. It was a good thing he'd come with a small arsenal. Dodging from rock to rock, tree to shrub, Kylar moved to the bridge. He unlimbered the heavy crossbow from his pack. He hated crossbows. They were unwieldy, slow, and could be shot by any idiot who could point. Kylar fitted the special bolt in place, checked the silk spool, and braced his body against the side of the bridge. What was it that Blint used to tell him? That he should practice more with weapons he didn't like? Scowling, Kylar aimed. Thanks to the iron sheathing on the bridge pilings, his target was tiny. He'd have to hit the last piling above the iron sheathing where the wood was exposed. A target 4 inches wide, from 40 paces away, with a slight breeze. This crossbow's accuracy at that range was within 2 inches, so he had 2 inches to spare. If he erred, he had to make sure he erred right. Up or down, and the bolt would hit iron, and the sound would wake the dead. Left, the bolt would fly past the bridge and hit the rocks of the castle, and probably rebound to splash in the river. Kylar hated crossbows. He waited until the boat was almost directly underneath the bridge. If he made the shot, when he made it, he'd take advantage of the boatmen having just left the brilliance of the dying sun and coming into the shadow of the castle. Their vision wouldn't be good. He exhaled half a breath and pulled smoothly, riding the release point until the catch gave. The bolt sped from the crossbow, the spool whizzing faintly, and the bolt sailed 4 inches to the right of the last piling. Kylar grabbed the still unreeling rope as it went taut. The bolt jerked to a stop not 3 feet from the castle wall. The bolt started falling, and Kylar pulled it in hand over hand as fast as he could. The rope draped over one of the crossbeams to the right of the piling he'd aimed for. It swung back toward the piling. Kylar dragged in rope as fast as he could, but the bolt pinged off the iron sheathing. The hooks on the bolt caught, and Kylar drew the rope taut, flush against the underside of the bridge. The Meister stepped to the edge of the bridge, holding on to the railing nervously. He looked down and saw the boat passing under the bridge. "Hey!" he called. "Watch it!" A lightly armed boatman looked up, squinting in the gloom.
"Right, you piece of..."
He swallowed his words as he realized he was speaking to a Meister. The Meister disappeared, and the boatman started haranguing his rowers. Both boatman and witch thought the other had made the sound. Without pausing to consider how lucky he was, Kylar secured his end of the line and hid the crossbow. The next boat was still a good distance away. Kylar threw a leg over the line, approached the precipice that sloped off to the river, and slipped out into space. For a long time, he thought he was going to die as the silk rope drooped toward the river. "It's come free." But he held on, and the rope finally accepted his weight. He climbed across the chasm almost upside down, pulling himself with his hands, his legs crossed over the rope. The droop of the rope meant that after he crossed the halfway point, he was climbing sideways and up. Instead of fighting it, Kylar just pulled himself as far as the second-to-last piling. He looked at the iron sheathing. It was pitted with age and exposure. It was also vertical, not exactly the best climbing surface. There was no good choice. Kylar had to get off the rope before the next boat came. He was invisible, but the drooping rope wasn't. He flung himself from the rope to the piling and fell. He slapped all of his limbs around the iron sheathing, but its diameter was so great that his arms couldn't reach around it. The uneven iron surface didn't provide enough friction to stop his descent, but it was enough to tear at the skin on the insides of his arms and his inner thighs. He hit the water slowly enough that the splash was quiet. He clambered back up to the surface and held himself against the piling as the next boat passed. With the number of weapons he was wearing, he couldn't swim, but when he pushed off the piling, he sank close enough to shore that he was able to walk along the river bottom and pull himself out of the water before he drowned. Barely. He moved north, along the same route he'd followed the night before. Kylar was glad Blint was dead. The wet boy would never have let him live this down. Between the missed shot and the undoubtedly embarrassing cuts he'd have on his inner thighs, Blint would have had jibes for a decade. Kylar could hear it now. "Remember that time you tried to hump the bridge?" Kylar found a perch inside the boathouse and cleaned his weapons. He'd have to assume that all of his poisons had washed away, for the second day in a row. He wrung out his clothes, but didn't dare take the time to let them dry fully. Now that he was here, he wanted to get in and get out, fast. He looked around the boathouse. It wasn't guarded. Evidently, the Caladorans thought their patrols were enough. The two men guarded the long ramp down that led to the maw. They were tense, obviously uncomfortable with their assignment. Kylar didn't blame them. Between the stink, the periodic cries, and the occasional rumblings in the earth, he wouldn't have been comfortable either. Retribution slashed left and right, and the men died. He pulled their bodies into the brush and took the keys to the door. The entrance to the maw was designed to terrify the men and women incarcerated there. On opening the gate, Kylar saw that the ramp down did indeed look like a tongue leading down a gigantic throat. Hooked teeth were carved out of the black volcanic glass around him, and torches were set behind red glass to look like two flickering demonic eyes. Nice. Kylar ignored everything except for the sounds of men. He glided down the tongue and turned down a hall toward the nobles' cells. From Durzo's friends he'd gained a rough idea of the layout of the place, but he'd certainly never had any wish to visit. He found the cell he was looking for, checked the door for traps, and spent a moment waiting in the hallway, just listening. It was insane. He was afraid to open the door. He was more afraid to face Eline and Uli than he was to sneak past witches and fight the Sakage. Gods! He was here to save Eline, and he was scared what she would say. Ridiculous. Or maybe what she wouldn't say. Just how she'd look at him. He'd given everything for her, but she didn't know that. All she could know was that she'd done nothing, and now she was in jail. Well, it wasn't going to get any better by waiting. Kylar picked the lock, released the Kakari's cloaking, and pulled down his black mask. The 10x10 cell was occupied by a pallet and a pretty little urchin sitting on Eline's lap. Kylar hardly noticed the little girl. His eyes were glued on Eline. She stared back at him, stunned. Her face was a mask, more literally than Kylar would have liked, since both of her eyes were blackened from where he'd hit her. She looked like a scarred raccoon. If it wasn't his fault and it were someone else, Kylar would have chuckled.
"Father!"
the little girl cried out. She squirmed out of Eline's lap. Still staring at Kylar, Eline barely noticed her go. Uli threw her arms around Kylar and hugged.
"Mother said you'd come. She swore you'd save us. Is she with you?"
Tearing his gaze away from Eline, whose eyes had suddenly narrowed, Kylar tried to pry the little girl loose. "Uli. You must be Uli," he said. "Mother? Did she mean Mama Kay or her nurse?" He'd straighten out this father business later. What was he going to say? Sorry, your mother's probably dead and I'm the one who killed her, but I changed my mind about it and gave her the antidote, so it's not my fault if she is dead. And I killed your father last night, too. I'm his best friend. Sorry. He bent down so she could look him in the eye. Your mother isn't with me, Uli, but I am here to save you. Can you be very, very quiet?
Quiet as a mouse, she said.
The kid was fearless. Either she had no sense, or Eline had done a hell of a job calming her fears. Hello, Eline, he said, standing.
Hello, whatever your name is. His name's Durzo, but we can call him Zoe,
Uli said. Kylar winked at her, glad for the interruption. Even if children were generally intolerable, she diverted a conversation he wasn't interested in having, especially not now. Not here. Eline glanced at Uli, then back to him, her eyes asking, "Is she yours?" Kylar shook his head. "You coming?" he asked. She scowled. He took it for a yes.
"Follow me," he told Uli. "Quiet as a mouse, right?"
Best get going and fast. Messy, emotional issues could wait until later. Or never. They followed as he walked, visible and nervous, to the ramp. Eline walked holding Uli's hand and stopped as Kylar went ahead. When they got to the carvings of teeth, Eline pulled Uli close and began speaking to her in soothing tones. Kylar walked up the ramp and eased the door open a crack. The door shook as three arrows smacked into the wood.
"Shit!"
Kylar said. It had been too easy. Kylar should have known. He'd been counting on the chaos to throw everyone off, locking the door again. Kylar snapped the key off in the lock. Let the bastards break it down.
"Back up the tunnel," he said, pulling Eline into a jog. "You won't see me, but I'll be here. I'll protect you, just listen for my voice," he said, as the black ooze of the Kakari bubbled out of his pores. If Eline were startled to have him disappear before her eyes, she hid it well. She jogged, pulling Uli along.
"Do I need to run?" she asked the empty air.
"Just walk fast," Kylar said.
The gate that led underground to the castle was unguarded. Thank the gods for that. Maybe the chaos of taking over an entire country would help him. Maybe a patrol outside had just stumbled across the bodies. Kylar locked the gate and broke off the other key. They climbed a staircase slowly and emerged in a service hallway in the castle proper. From the hallway, they quickly came upon an intersection. Down one hall, off-duty Caladoran soldiers were slouching against a wall and sharing a joke. Kylar stopped Eline and walked toward them, then heard one of them call something to someone inside the open room behind them. If he killed them, whoever was in that room would sound an alarm. He could make it, but Eline and Uli wouldn't. He went back to Eline.
"Go when I say," he said.
"Now!" Eline threw her shawl over her head and struggled across the hallway, her back bent and her face down, one foot turned in and dragging along the floor. She looked like an old crone, and she blocked most of Uli from view. It took her longer to get across the opening, but when one of the soldiers saw her, he didn't even say anything to the others.
"Nice trick," Kylar said, catching up with her as she resumed her normal fast stride.
"Where I grew up, stupid girls don't stay virgins," Eline said.
"You grew up on the east side," Kylar said. "It's not exactly like the Warrens over there."
"You think it's safer to work around oversexed nobles?"
"Where are we going?" Uli asked.
"Shh," Kylar said as they approached another intersection. The hallway they had been following led to the kitchens. From the raucous voices there, though, that wasn't the way to take Eline and Uli. The door to the right was locked, and the hall left was clear. Kylar pulled out his picks, risking the possibility of someone stepping out of the kitchens. He didn't like the idea of following the path of least resistance. The lock came open quickly, but something heavy had been wedged against the door on the other side, probably a servant who had done his best to block it during the coup.
"Where are we going?" Uli asked again.
Kylar had known her cuteness would grate on him. He'd just hoped it would take longer than this. He let Eline hush her this time. With his talent, he could kick through the door and whatever was blocking it, but the noise would bring whoever was in the kitchens, and Kylar felt a sense of urgency. He didn't want to leave the girls here while he scouted.
"Left," he whispered.
This corridor twisted and rose up several flights of steps. Kylar heard the jingling of mail and the slap of feet in hobnailed boots behind them.
"Hurry,"
he said. The men behind them were moving at a slow jog, so they weren't chasing escaped prisoners, but just responding to orders. Kylar dropped back to the staircase and caught a brief glimpse of at least 20 men. He ran to catch up with Eline and Uli. They were passing doors and heedless of who might hear. Kylar started testing the latches. Every one was locked.
"Why are we going to the throne room?" Uli asked.
Kylar stopped. Eline stared at Uli, looking as surprised as he felt.
"What?"
he asked.
"Why are we going?"
"How do you know where we're going?" Kylar asked.
"I live here. Mother's a maid. Our room's just..."
"Uli, do you know a way out? A way that doesn't go to the throne room? Quick."
"I'm not supposed to come up here," she said. "I get in trouble."
"Damn it," Kylar said. "Do you know a way out or not?"
She shook her head, frightened. That would have just been too easy, wouldn't it?
"Great with children, aren't you?" Eline said.
She touched Uli's cheek and squatted on her heels to look her in the face.
"Have you come up here, Uli?"
Eline asked gently.
"We won't be angry if you have, I promise."
But Uli was too frightened to say anything. The footsteps were getting closer.
"Move,"
Kylar said, grabbing Eline's hand to get her running, making her drag the brat. He didn't like this. It was too tidy, too convenient that there was only one path.
"One path?" "That's it. There's never just one path in this castle."
Kylar scanned the walls and ceilings as he ran. He didn't even try the doors that they passed. They turned another corner. Kylar skittered to a stop. He shimmered back into visibility.
"Eline, do you see that third panel?"
He pointed up.
"No,"
she said.
"But what do I need to do?"
"Push on it. I'll lift you. There are secret corridors throughout this castle. Find your way out. Maybe Uli can help you." She nodded, and Kylar squatted against the wall. Eline hitched up her skirts and stepped on his thigh. She scowled as she realized that climbing up on him would drape her skirts over his head, but she didn't hesitate to step up to his shoulders and finally into his hands. She walked her hands up the wall for balance. Then Kylar stood and extended his hands, lifting her high into the air. Eline pushed the panel open and slipped inside a crawl space. She had turned around by the time Kylar picked up Uli.
"Can you catch?"
he asked.
"I'd better,"
she said. The footsteps were almost on top of them. Kylar tossed Uli up in the air, easily.
Damn, but the talent is useful.
Eline caught her and started to slip until her own shoulders were sticking out over space. Then she must have braced herself against something inside the crawl space because she stopped. She grunted, and with Uli wiggling to help, was able to pull the girl up with her.
"Oh, I've been here,"
Uli said. Kylar took out a dagger and tossed it up to Eline. She caught it.
"What am I supposed to do with this?"
"Aside from the obvious?" he asked.
"Thanks. Now come on, there's room. Hurry!"
Kylar didn't move.
Dorian said, "If you do the right thing twice, it will cost you your life."
Blint said, "There are things more valuable than life." The Count said,
"You can't pay for all you've done, but you aren't beyond redemption. There's always a way out. And if you're willing to make the sacrifice, the god will give you the chance to save something priceless."
He looked at Eileen. Something priceless, indeed. He smiled at her. She looked at him like he was crazy.
"Kylar, hurry!"
"It's a trap, Eileen. If they lose me here, they'll search the hidden passages.
I can't protect you in the crawl spaces, they're too cramped. Get out of the castle. Go to Jarl at the Blue Boar. He'll help you."
"They'll kill you, Kylar. If it's a trap, you can't—"
"I did look," he interrupted. He smirked. "And you've got great legs." He winked and disappeared.
Chapter 63. Voidmeister Nefdada damned Roth Orsul for the 100th time of the day. Serving an Aethling of the God King was supposed to be an honor. Like all the God King's honors, this one came with strings attached. If an Aethling failed his Urdan, his Voidmeister was punished with him, and obedience was required, total obedience, except in things that might displease the God King. Which was why Neff was cursing. He wasn't precisely disobeying Roth, but he was undoing something the prince had begun, something, in fact, that Roth believed he had accomplished. Something that it was taking all of Neff's abilities to stop. Mercifully, Roth had been too busy securing the castle and the city to ask where his Voidmeister was. Besides, he had 60 Meisters to command now, 3 of them Voidmeisters, almost as powerful as Neff. If Roth had sent men after him, the small servants' room Neff had commandeered was isolated enough that they had never been able to find him. His work, his petty deceit and rebellion and gamble for the God King's favor, lay stretched out on the bed. She was a beautiful girl. Not that the God King needed another beautiful girl, but she had spirit. Fiery, intelligent, and best of all, a widowed virgin bride and a princess. Jeanine Gyre was a prize indeed, a prize to crown the God King's harem, a prize Neff had snatched from the very jaws of death. Every Voidmeister as old as he was knew volumes about preserving life, of course. It was in their own self-interest as they grew old. But I'm a genius. A genius. His plan had crystallized as Roth had ranted, meaningless words exploding from the boy like diarrhea. As usual, his cut had been fortunate, just one side of the neck, not so deep that it cut the windpipe. Neff let her bleed until she was losing strength, then tickled a little tendril of magic against her diaphragm to push the air from her lungs, 2 more to close her eyes, a 4th to seal the wound on her neck, some quick movement to take attention away from her body so no one would notice that she was still breathing. And the girl had been his. He'd killed 7 serving girls looking for the right kind of blood for her. Sloppy work. He should have done better, but it had been enough. He decided to leave the scar. It gave the princess a certain something. And as a finishing touch, he'd found a girl in the city who looked like the princess and had her head mounted over the east gate with the rest of the royal families. If you got the right color of hair and styled it correctly, all you had to do was beat the face enough, and it could look like anyone's head. Still, he thought, he'd done brilliant work, even if it had been exhausting. Tomorrow morning the God King would arrive, and he'd dispense either favor or punishment to Roth Orsul. Either way, Neff would prosper. Something made him pause before he went out the door. Something felt odd outside. He walked to his window, threw open the wooden shutters, no glass for the servants' rooms,
and stared through the hole into the ghastly Cenarian statue garden. The Meisters had set up their camp there, figuring it to be a center of power. Verdmeister Gorol had always enjoyed thumbing his nose at the conquered country's gods and dead kings. It was pure play-acting not to take rooms in the castle, but when the Meisters went to war, Gorol liked to show the god-king that they were roughing it. Insufferable. A man climbed up onto one of the statues. Neff couldn't see his features clearly, but he certainly wasn't Caladoran. Sethi? What's a Sethi man with a sword doing climbing a statue in the middle of a war? A giant of a blacksmith, with blonde hair, stood below him, looking around anxiously. Neff shook his head. Verdmeister Gorol wouldn't take such an insult lightly.
"Witches of the God-King!"
the man shouted, his voice booming, amplified a dozen times over with magic. A mage?
"Witches of the false God-King, hear me! Come to me! This day on the rock you will be shattered! Come, and let your arrogance find its reward!"
Had he not spoken heresy, the witches might have let Verdmeister Gorol deal with him, but heresy would be stopped, must be stopped, instantly. Fully 30 Meisters drew on their veer. Neff's magical senses exploded. He lurched against the wall and collapsed. It felt like 1,000 demons were screaming in unison into each of his ears. Magic, like a bonfire, like a second sun, exploded through the castle. Neff felt his veer tingling, burning as magic washed toward him. He hadn't been holding his veer, and that was surely the one thing that saved him. The power pouring through the castle was more magic than he'd ever imagined, more magic than the God-King himself could wield. Specks of magic leaped up to meet it. The Meisters, Neff could tell. The Meisters who hadn't already been holding their veer grabbed it. They might as well have been flies trying to extinguish a bonfire with the wind from their wings. The magic sought them out, wrapped around them, burned them to pillars of ash. He could feel the tendrils of their power snapping, bursting apart one by one. The conflagration was in the courtyard, in that odd Cenarian statue garden. Should Neff stay here and live? Did he dare go face that fire? What would this titan of a mage do if Neff dared to confront him? What would the God-King do to him if he didn't? An odd, detached thought came to Kylar as he opened the last door and walked toward the throne room. That's why those guards outside the mall were nervous. They were bait. Now I am, too. His next thought was of Durzo's creed. Life is empty. It was a creed Durzo himself had betrayed, an empty creed. It neither saved life nor made it better. For a wet boy, it made life safer because it obliterated his conscience. Or tried to. Durzo had tried to live that creed and had found himself too noble for it. Kylar wondered what had brought him to this. He was ready to die. Was it pride that he thought he could defy any odds? Was it duty to Durzo that he thought he had to pay back the debt of his life by saving Uli? Was it revenge that he hated Roth so much that he would die to kill him? Was it love? Love? I'm a fool. He felt something for Eline, it was true, something intense and intoxicating and unreasonable. Maybe it was love, but what did he love? Eline, or an image of her, glimpsed from afar, pieced together with the glue of assumption? Maybe it was just some last vestige of romanticism that had brought him here, some sludge left over from the stories of princes and heroes Ulana Drake had read to him. Maybe he'd spent too long with the people who believed in false virtues like valor and self-sacrifice that Durzo had tried to teach him to despise. Maybe he'd been infected. but why he was here didn't really matter. This was the right thing to do. He was worthless. If his empty life could ransom Eileen's life, then he would have accomplished something good. It would be the only thing he had ever done that he could be proud of, and if he gave Uli a chance too, so much the better. He'd have his own chance too. His chance at Roth. Kylar had gone into other fights feeling confident, but this was different. As he stepped into the short hall to the throne room, Kylar felt at peace. A high-pitched whine cut the air. The men who'd been standing in the room looking to the door adjusted their grips on their weapons. A magical alarm to tell them I've arrived, then. There were Highlanders, of course. He'd expected that. But he hadn't expected 30. And there were witches. He'd expected that, too. But not 5. The doors at the dead end where he'd lifted Eileen and Uli banged open, and another 10 Highlanders poured in behind him. Taking a few quick steps, Kylar leaped into the throne room at the level of the floor, hoping to make it past the first attacks. The room was huge, the ivory and horned throne set above the seats of the assembly by 2 broad sets of 7 steps, separated by a flat landing. Roth sat in the throne, flanked by 2 witches. The others stood on the landing. The Highlanders were spreading around the perimeter of the room. The leap took him past the whirring swords of 2 Highlanders, who were cutting blindly at the air in front of the door, hoping to get lucky and hit the invisible wet boy. Drawing retribution from its back scabbard, Kylar rolled to his feet. A swarm of tiny hands appeared in the air as the witches chanted. The hands were looking for him, plucking at him. They seethed over the ground, leaping and clawing at each other as they groped for him. He jumped away, cutting at the hands, but his sword passed through them harmlessly. There was nothing for him to cut. They swarmed over him, and the hands thickened, strengthened as 2 of the witches chanted in time with each other. Then, as the hands pulled him upright, Kylar felt something else seize him. He felt like a baby caught in a giant's fingers. It tore at him, and he felt the Kakari's cloaking strip open. He let it go. It wouldn't do him much good to be partly invisible if he couldn't move. Well, that was glorious. In all the history of stupid men intentionally springing traps set for them, that was probably the lamest result ever. Kylar had hoped, hell, expected, that he'd at least take a few guards with him, maybe a witch. 2 would have been nice. Durzo would be shaking his head in disgust.
"I knew you'd come, Blint."
Roth crowed from the throne. He hopped to his feet and waved to the witches. Kylar was lifted off his feet and shot forward, carried magically up the stairs and deposited on the landing below the throne. Blint! Gods! I sprang a trap that wasn't even set for me. The magic fingers tore away Kylar's mask.
"Kylar?"
Roth said, astonished. He burst out laughing.
"My prince, beware," a red-haired witch at Roth's right said. "He has the Kakari."
Roth slapped his hands together and laughed again, as if unable to believe his luck.
"And just in time! Oh, Kylar, if I were another man, I'd almost let you live."
The witty riposte dried on Kylar's tongue as he saw into Roth's eyes. If most of his debtors had a cupful of darkness in their souls, Roth had a river, boundless and bleak, a roaring, devouring darkness with a voice like thunder. Here was a man who hated all that was lovely.
"Captain," Roth said, "where are the girl and the scarred wench?"
One of the men who'd entered after Kylar said,
"We lost them, Your Majesty."
"I'm disappointed, Captain," Roth said, but his voice was jubilant. unloose them.
Yes, Your Highness, the soldier said. He grabbed his 10 Highlanders and headed back into the hall. Roth turned back to Kylar.
Now, he said. Dessert.
Kylar, do you know how long I've been looking for you? Kylar blinked and tore himself away, somehow shut his senses off to the evil in the man before him. He forced nonchalance into his voice.
Since I'm the man who's going to kill you, I'd guess, oh, since you first looked in the mirror and realized just how damn ugly you are.
Roth clapped his hands. How droll! You know, Kylar, I feel like you've been in my shadow for years, opposing everything I've done. Stealing my Kakari really irritated me.
Well, I aim to vex, Kylar said.
He wasn't really listening. Opposing him for years? Roth really was crazy. Kylar didn't even know him. But let the man rant as long as he wanted. Kylar surreptitiously flexed against the bonds of magic. They were like steel. This was not going well. Kylar didn't have a plan. He didn't even have the beginning of a plan. He didn't think that there was a plan that might have worked, even if he'd been smart enough to think of it. The Caladoran soldiers had encircled him. The witches were watching him like vultures, their veer wriggling faintly. And Roth looked altogether far too pleased with himself.
And vex you do. You seem to turn up at the most inopportune moments.
Just like that rash you picked up from the rent boys, huh?
Oh, personality. Excellent. I haven't had a really satisfying kill since yesterday.
If you fell on your sword, we'd all be satisfied.
You had your chance to kill me, Kylar, Roth shrugged.
You failed.
But I didn't know you were a wet boy. I only got your real name yesterday, and killing you had to wait while I gained a kingdom for my father.
I won't hold it against you.
I had my chance. So gracious in defeat. Did Durzo teach you that?
Kylar had no response. It was probably stupid at this point to feel irked that he seemed to have lost a point in the battle of wits. But then, if Kylar had been smarter, he wouldn't have been here in the first place.
I must say, Roth said, I've not been impressed with this generation of wet boys. Hugh's apprentice was as much of a disappointment as you are. I mean, really. Durzo would have at least killed one of my men before we caught him, don't you think?
I'm afraid you're a poor shadow of your master, Kylar. By the way, where is he? It's not like him to have an inferior do a job that concerns him.
I killed him last night. For working for you.
The prince clapped his hands with glee and giggled.
I think that's the most lovely thing I've ever heard. He betrayed me by saving you, and you betrayed him for working for me. Oh, Kylar!
Roth came down the steps to stand in front of him.
If I could trust you damn wet boys, I'd hire you in a heartbeat. But you're too dangerous, and, of course, you've bonded my Kakari.
Roth's witch shifted, obviously nervous to have Roth standing so close to Kylar. The witch must know something I don't, Kylar thought. He couldn't move a muscle. He was totally helpless.
Wait. That's it.
That's exactly why he's nervous. He thinks the Kakari's a threat, and if he thinks it is, maybe it is. Roth drew a beautiful long sword from a hip scabbard.
I'm disappointed with you.
Why's that? Kylar asked, racking his brain to think of how he might use the Kakari. What did he know about it? It enabled his talent. It made him see through shadows. It made him invisible. It came out of his skin and hid him more perfectly than any wet boy could hide.
But how?
I'd hoped this would be fun, Roth said. I was going to tell you how hard you made my life, but you're like Blint.
You don't even care if you live or die.
Roth raised the sword. Sure I do, Kylar said, showing fear.
How hard have I made your life?
Sorry. I'm not going to give you the satisfaction.
Oh, come on.
Not for me, Kylar said.
You know your father's Meisters and soldiers are going to report everything they've seen and heard to him. Why not give them the whole story?
It was clumsy, but with his life on the line it was harder to think quickly than he would have imagined. Roth paused, thinking. It was useless. The Kakari just did what it did. It had eaten a knife last night, for God's sake. There was no telling by what logic it operated, if any. It was just magic. Absorbs. Eats. That's what it does. He'd felt a huge jolt of power after it had absorbed the knife. The Devourer. Blint had called it the Devourer. He was close, maybe.
Sorry, Roth said. I don't perform for anyone, not even you.
This is just between us, Azoth. Roth handed his sword to the witch to his left and smoothed his long hair back over his ears. Except he didn't have ears. The left ear looked like it had been melted off. The right ear had been cut off. Azoth had been pushed to his knees in the middle of the boat shop. It had been hard to get Rat to come into the dark shop, but he'd done it. Now Rat's foot was squarely in the middle of the noose Azoth had laid on the floor, but Azoth couldn't move. He couldn't draw full breath. Rat was inches away. Terrifying in his nakedness, giving an order. He clouted Azoth. Azoth tasted blood. He found himself moving. He grabbed the noose and snugged the knot tight against Rat's ankle. Rat shouted and raised his knee sharply into Azoth's face. He landed on the big rock and scraped his back, falling between the rock and the hole in the floor where boats had once been lowered into the river's foul waters. He scrambled and braced his thin arms against the rock and lifted his eyes, expecting the older boy to already be on him. Rat looked at Azoth, at the hole, at the rock, at the rope, at his ankle. Azoth would never forget the look in Rat's eyes. It was terror. Then Rat lunged, and Azoth shoved the rock into the hole. The rope went tight, and Rat was pulled to the side in mid-lunge. He scrambled, grabbing for Azoth, missing. His fingers raked the rotting wood floor as he slid and disappeared into the hole. There was a splash. But moments later, Azoth heard crying. He walked to the edge of the hole. Rat was holding on by his fingertips, begging. It was impossible. Then Azoth saw that his rock had landed on one of the lattice-like support beams that held the shop up over the river. It was balanced precariously, but as long as Rat held tension on the rope, it wouldn't drag him into the depths. Azoth walked to Rat's pile of clothing and found his dagger. Rat was pleading, tears coursing down his pimply cheeks, but Azoth heard only the roar of blood in his ears. He squatted by Rat, careful but fearless. Even now, Rat's arms were shaking from holding his weight. He was too fat to hold himself for long, too fat to let go with one hand and grab Azoth. With a quick motion, Azoth grabbed his ear and sliced it off. Rat screamed and let go. His body hit the rock, dislodged it. The last thing Azoth saw was his terrified face as he was pulled under the water. Then, even that was obscured by his hands churning, reaching for something, anything. Finding nothing, Azoth waited and waited, and then staggered away. The pimples were gone. He'd grown a beard to cover the few pits they'd left. The build was right, though. He'd lost weight since he left the Warrens, but that jaggedly cut ear, and his eyes, gods! How didn't I notice those dead eyes? The eyes were the same. Rat. Kylar breathed. His plan burst into 1,000 shards. His heart stopped. He felt like a child again, waiting in line for Rat to beat him, too cowardly to do anything but weep.
I'm dead. Right? Funny. That's what they told me about you.
Roth shook his head, but his voice was low. This was just for him.
Neff burned off my other ear to punish me for what you did. You cost me 3 years, Azoth, 3 years before I became a guild head again. I held my breath for gods. It seemed like forever. Forever working at the knot you tied on my ankle, bleeding my life out into that filthy water until Neff finally pulled me out. He watched the whole thing, said he was debating letting me die. Neff had to kill one of my bigs, you remember Roth, don't you? And put him in my place before your master came. I had to move to some shitty guild on the opposite side of the Warrens and start all over. You almost made me fail my father.
He was shaking with rage. He exposed his melted ear again.
This was the least of my punishments. And then you conveniently died.
I never believed it.
Azoth. I knew you were out there just waiting for me. Believe me, if I had time, I would torture you for years. I would push you to the end of human endurance and beyond. I'd heal you, just to make you hurt again.
He closed his eyes and lowered his voice once more.
But I don't have that luxury. If I leave you alive, my father might come up with other plans for you. He might do something else with the Kakari. I paid for that Kakari, and I intend to bond it immediately.
He smiled grimly.
Any last words?
Kylar had lost his focus, gotten distracted. Fear and horror had made his mind wander from the puzzle when nothing should have been as important. Durzo had taught him better. Fear was to be acknowledged, then ignored.
Where had he been? Devourer? Magic? Shit!
He said, not realizing he spoke aloud. Roth arched an eyebrow.
Boring, but accurate enough.
His grip turned on his sword, and his shoulder rolled back. The blade was coming up. The man was going to cut his head off. Everything in Kylar cried out for help. A boom sounded somewhere below the range of human hearing, but Kylar felt it wallop his stomach like a thundercrack. His vision went blue-white with magic. He could see the magic streaming through the air as fast as an arrow, a wall of magic. The castle itself rocked, and everyone fell. Everywhere he looked, Kylar saw the same stunned looks. Roth was sprawled on the stairs, his sword still in his hand, mouth wide. Kylar suddenly felt one of the magic bonds holding him snap. He looked toward the others and saw that the magic, it looked like a storm of blue-white rain falling sideways, flying invisibly through walls and people, was spattering against the bonds, collecting around them. The bonds were as black as the witch's veer, and the blue magic hissed and spat wherever it touched the black. Then, the blue magic latched on to the witch's magic and roared up the black tendrils like wildfire climbing a hill to the witches holding them. Shrieks burst from three of the witches, and the bonds holding Kylar disappeared as three living blue torches lit the room. But Kylar's eyes were drawn to himself. The Kakari was covering him like a black skin, and everywhere the blue magic pelted him, the magic danced like a puddle in the rain, then disappeared, and the Kakari swelled, more powerful. The Devourer ate magic, too. Then the magical shockwave was gone. There was the briefest silence. Then Roth screamed at the witches who hadn't been using the veer. The two witches in the room still alive.
Get him!
Roth plucked his sword from the stairs and swung it at Kylar's face. Incredibly, the witches obeyed instantly. Bonds leapt into place around Kylar's arms and legs. Everywhere the bonds touched Kylar, in response to his will, the Kakari swelled, twisted through them, shifted, sucked, and devoured them. Kylar threw himself back against the bonds, even before they were completely dissolved. He burst through them with all the strength of his talent as Roth's sword slashed the air inches from his throat. He tore through the shriveling bonds and flew back clumsily, his feet tearing free last, tripping him. He twisted in the air and threw a knife with his off hand. A soldier grunted and hit the floor. Kylar landed below the second flight of steps, flat on his back. The impact knocked the wind out of him, but even as he slid across the floor, his sword was moving. Highlanders stood to the left and right of him, and his sword flashed twice, cutting through boots and ankles on either side of him. Three Highlanders had fallen, but others were already attacking. Kylar flipped his feet over his head and stood, gasping, but ready to fight. Chapter 64 Solon tried to climb down from the statue. King Logan Verdroken had been one of the earliest kings of Cenaria, perhaps mythic, and Solon couldn't remember what he'd done. For all that, it must have been heroic to have Regnus Gyre name his son after him, and he must have been special to get a statue of such size, holding his sword aloft in defiance. Solon had chosen it, not for its metaphoric significance, but simply because he wanted every Meister in the garden to see him, every Meister that had used Veer within 500 paces in the few seconds he'd been able to hold Kurok, was dead. Kurok lay on the stones beneath him. Fear was snatching it up and wrapping it in a blanket. He was shouting at Solon, but Solon couldn't make out the words. He still felt as if he were on fire. Every vein in his body was tingling so fiercely, it was hard to even feel Verdroken's stone sword under his fingers. Solon had perched on the dead king's shoulders and held on to the stone sword for balance, holding Kurok aloft the same way when he'd released the magic. He shifted his grip, his legs shaking, and suddenly fell. Fear didn't quite catch him, but he at least broke his fall.
"I can't walk," Solon said.
His brain was burning, his vision flaring every color in the rainbow. His scalp felt afire.
"It was amazing, Fear. Such a tiny piece of what it can do!"
Fear grabbed him and threw him over his shoulders, as a lesser man might lift a child. He said something, but Solon couldn't quite make it out. He said again.
"Oh, I got about 50 of them, maybe 10 left," Solon said.
"One on the East Bridge." He was trying to remember what Dorian had told him, something urgent, something he hadn't let Fear hear.
"Don't let Fear die. He's more important than the sword." "I'm going to have to set you down," Fear said. "Don't worry, I'm not leaving you."
In outrageous hues of green and blue, Caladoran soldiers were swarming in front of the east gate. Solon couldn't even remember leaving the garden. He laughed at what he saw. Fear was using Kurok as a sword. Watching Fear with a sword was more than amazing. It was a privilege. Fear had always been a natural, deceptively quick, unbelievably strong. His movements as precise as a dancer's. In hues of green and blue and red, Fear demolished the soldiers. There was no extended sword play. At most, each soldier had time to swing his own weapon once, miss or have it parried, and then die. Fear cursed, But when Solon tried to follow his gaze, the riot of colors was too intense. The big man lifted him, threw him over a shoulder again, and started running. Solon saw the wood of the bridge beneath Fi'ir's feet.
"Hold on tight," Fi'ir said.
Not a moment too soon, Solon latched on to Fi'ir's belt on either side of the man's broad back. Fi'ir dodged to the side, and his great shoulders rolled. With his feet sticking out in front of Fi'ir, and his head merely bobbing along behind him, all Solon saw was a brief flash of Curoc. Fi'ir spun, the right way so Solon wasn't flung off, and Curoc came up again. Then he was running full speed once more. Solon saw three bodies behind them, lying on the bridge. The man had killed three men while holding Solon over his shoulder. Astounding! Fi'ir said,
"Dorian told me our hope is in the water, but not to jump. Look for a rope."
Solon lifted his head, as if he would be much help in finding a rope while bouncing on Fi'ir's back. He didn't see a rope, but he did see a Meister behind them, conjuring a ball of witchfire. He tried to yell, but couldn't draw breath.
"Damn you, Dorian!" Fi'ir was shouting. "What goddamn rope?"
"Down!"
Solon said. With the reflexes of the swordmaster he was, Fi'ir dropped instantly. Witchfire crackled over their heads and burst against a dozen Caladoran soldiers holding the far gate in front of them. Solon went sprawling and was almost brained by one of the great fire pots that guarded the bridge. The old witch behind them, from his thickness of his veer, Solon guessed he was a Verdmeister, was drawing magic once more. Fi'ir grabbed Solon's collar and threw him behind the firepot. The move put Solon in a safe place, but exposed Fi'ir. This time, it wasn't witchfire, but something else Solon had never seen. An angry red beam didn't so much fly as streak through the air toward Fi'ir. He threw up a magical shield and ducked. The shield barely deflected the beam, again into a soldier running to join the fray, but the force of the magic blew Fi'ir's shield apart and flung him to the other side like a rag doll. Curoc spun from his grasp. Drawing on strength he didn't know he had, Solon grabbed Fi'ir and pulled him into the shadow of the firepot with him. Two more Meisters were running to join the Verdmeister, and soldiers were behind them. The gate at the far end of the bridge opened, and soldiers were pouring through. Fi'ir sat up and looked out at Curoc, 20 feet away, exposed.
"I can use it," he said. "I can save it."
"No," Solon said. "You'll die."
The soldiers and the Meisters had paused, regrouping, advancing slowly now, cautious and orderly.
"I don't matter, Solon. We can't let them have it." "You wouldn't even live long enough to use it, Fi'ir. Not even if you were willing to trade your life for 1 second of power." "It's right there."
"And so is this,"
Solon said, motioning to the edge of the bridge. Fi'ir looked.
"You've got to be joking."
Over the edge, a black silk rope had been tied to the underside of either end of the bridge. It only extended out below them when the wind blew. Fi'ir was looking, not at the rope, but at the fall.
"Hey, it's the prophecy, right? It has to work,"
Solon said. If only the world would stop flashing yellow.
"It never works out exactly like Dorian says."
"If he told you that you were going to do this, would you have come?"
"Hell no! And don't you nod knowingly at me? I get enough of that from Dorian."
Fi'ir looked at the approaching soldiers and Meisters.
"Right, you first."
"He's going to go after Curoc, the heroic idiot."
"I can't," Solon said. "I'm not strong enough to grab the rope. I'll die if I go alone."
Fi'ir stood.
"Just let me try."
He reached out with his talent and grabbed the sword. Instantly, hands of Vir crackled visibly over his magic and started climbing toward him. Solon slashed the magic loose with his own.
Spots exploded in front of Solon's eyes.
Oh, don't do that! Don't do that, please! Oh!
Let me ride pony back, Fia.
Solon didn't have time.